Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons are commanded to keep silent on pain of imprisonment while the Senate of the United States is sitting for the trial of the articles of impeachment exhibited by the House of Representatives against Donald John Trump, President of the United States.
And with that, the U.S. Senate last week began to play its part in the impeachment trial, a process that has riveted some Americans and bored others. Now, as the last chapters of this saga begin, we'd like to gauge your reaction. How much attention are you paying to the impeachment trial? What are the most important elements of this for you? And what questions do you have about the process itself? Let us know with an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. With me in studio is John Grabe, professor of law at UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law and director of its Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service. And John Grabe, thank you, as always, for helping us out.
Oh,
we appreciate
thanks for having
it.
Me.
And joining us by phone is Dan Cassino, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fairleigh Dickinson University and a frequent contributor to NHPR's Civics 101 podcast. And Dan, a big welcome back to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Oh, always a pleasure.
Well, so, John, as a constitutional lawyer, what's interesting for you about what's been happening in the Senate this week?
Well, you know, right from the beginning, the issue has been to what extent is what's going on in the Senate supposed to resemble a judicial trial? You know, what really has struck me, particularly as the opening arguments shifted from the House managers to, you know, the defense team, is the extent to which this really differs from being a trial, you know, a trial in the federal judicial system, and how really starkly political it is, and for better or worse, it bears some resemblance to a trial, but at bottom, it's politics.
Well, can you explain that a little bit more, John? Because you're right. A lot of the language that has been used is the language we associate with a regular old court trial, you know, jurors and due process and fair. The word fair has been thrown around a lot. So how is an impeachment trial like a regular trial and how is it not?
Well, it is like a regular trial. I mean, actually, the Constitution makes reference to the word try. The Senate shall try,
okay,
you know, these articles of impeachment. The senators themselves serve in a role that is comparable to the role of jurors. But jurors are fact witnesses in a regular federal trial. Senators are much more than just fact witnesses here. They are also ones who make up the rules. They are the ones who ultimately decide on what evidence they're going to hear, what witnesses they're going to hear from, and whether they're going to hear, you know, evidence or witnesses too. So that's a pretty substantial difference.
John, right?
Yes, they are.
Interesting. Well, and here is one of President Trump's attorneys, Jay Sokolow. He's saying this whole impeachment process has ignored certain basic rights.
During the proceedings that took place before the Judiciary Committee, the president was denied the right to cross-examine witnesses. The president was denied the right to access evidence. And the president was denied the right to have counsel present at hearings. That's a trifecta. A trifecta that violates the Constitution of the United States.
Okay, so John, does the president have those usual rights that you or I would have if we were in a court process?
Well, there's no law out there that the president could point to and to say this is directly on point. There's, you know, the judiciary really doesn't involve itself in impeachment. The judiciary has invoked a doctrine known as the political question doctrine to say this is really up to the other two branches. One would like to think, excuse me. One would like to think that basic due process guarantees would be provided, you know, both during the the decision leading up to impeachment and then to the trial. Again, it's really up to the politicians to decide what, you know, how the procedures are going to work and what the president is or is not going to be able to do.
That's interesting. So, again, similar language, but you have lawmakers here acting as both judge and jury.
That's right.
That's the difference. So, Dan Cascino, as a political scientist now, how are you hearing what happened in this Senate phase?
So the most interesting thing for me over the past couple days was the way that the president's advisors and the president's defenders were talking about this at the Senate. So they're making a lot of really interesting arguments. I actually found it to be really educational, right, because they're talking about what the purpose of impeachment is. And we're really getting a constitutional debate about what impeachment is supposed to be about. This has hinged less on what the president did or did not do. And the arguments have been much more about what is impeachment supposed to be for? What's the proper role of impeachment in the overall system of the balance of powers? The president's defenders are essentially saying that impeachment can't be used by Congress under circumstances like this. That unless there is some crime that is somehow bipartisan that everyone agrees is a crime, well, then you can't do it. Or even saying that impeachment requires there to be a criminal act, as Ken Starr argued on Monday. And we even got yesterday the closing arguments of the president's defenders where they were saying, look, even if you think the president did this, even if you think maybe he should be removed for this, it doesn't matter because we're going to have an election. And you should just let the elections determine this. And that's really a fundamental change in the way that we approach oversight and the way that we approach the impeachment process. If we're saying, well, there's limitations on when we can and should use impeachment. In addition, there has been this whole debate about the second article of impeachment, which really hasn't come up very much. We've been talking a lot about the first article. The first article is about the president abusing his power. The second article is, I think, really the more important one going forward, and that's the article where we're asking about the president's unwillingness to send witnesses or the president's orders to members of the cabinet not to come to the Senate, not to come to Congress, and not to participate in the impeachment hearings. If that stands as precedent, future presidents would be able to point back and say, look, I'm not going to send anyone over because I don't think this is a legitimate exercise. Now, if that happens, that's a fundamental shift in the way the balance of power works. If the president can essentially avoid oversight in the future, simply by saying, I disagree with what the Congress is trying to do here.
Well, Dan, since you mentioned that closing argument made by Pat Cipollone, White House counsel, yesterday, I just want to play that for listeners because and get a couple more thoughts from you gentlemen on it. Because here he is making the case that the president's lawyers made over the last couple of days, that basically this is all about politics and elections.
Why not trust the American people with this decision? Why tear up their ballots? Why tear up every ballot across this country? You can't do that. You know you can't do that. So I ask you to defend our Constitution, to defend fundamental fairness, to defend basic due process rights, but most importantly, to respect and defend the sacred right of every American to vote and to choose their president.
So, Dan, what do you think about that? Yeah, all the impeachment stuff, we can talk about it, due process, but really, this is about letting voters who voted for Donald Trump have the president they selected.
And this is really an argument against the concept of impeachment in general. Impeachment necessarily means undoing an election, right? Removing the president that the voters put into place. Now, it's not, of course, completely removing the election, simply because the vice president, who was also picked in that election, would then become president. But this is an argument against impeachment conceptually, saying you cannot have an impeachment because impeachment necessarily removes the president from office. And that's really a striking argument. If this was a trial, essentially the president's defenders would be arguing for what we call jury nullification, saying even if you think the charges are true, I still don't want you to convict because we think it's unfair that the charges are brought in the first place. As John can tell you, in a trial, you are not allowed to argue that. So this is veering very far away from what we'd see in normal federal rules of evidence.
I think it's so interesting, John, what Dan says, that one of the main cases that the president's lawyers made wasn't with the facts of the matter and disputing them, although there was plenty of that, too, but just that, you know, disputing impeachment itself. We shouldn't even be here.
Right. And just to pick up on what Dan just said, you know, in a regular court proceeding, that is not something that would ever get to the jury. You know, the judge will make the legal determination of the sufficiency of the indictment and whether the allegations are sufficient to go ahead with the trial. And then the jurors are just supposed to find the facts. But again, because of this dual role that the senators are playing, There is an appeal going on here that really is akin to jury nullification, and really does invite a completely new understanding, at the very least, of the impeachment and removal power. And as Dan suggests, really suggests almost reading it out of the Constitution.
Well, we heard that argument again from one of the president's lawyers, Pat Cipollone. It was also made by another member of the president's team. This is Jay Sekulow. He is, again, saying this is all one big political witch hunt. Let's hear.
Why are we here? Are we here because of a phone call? Or are we here before this great body because since the president was sworn into office, there was a desire to see him removed?
All right, Exchange listeners, we want your thoughts about what happened in the U.S. Senate over the past several days. We had presentations from U.S. House managers, then the president's lawyers. Now the last chapters of this saga are about to begin, and we'd love to gauge your reaction. First of all, how much attention are you paying to the impeachment trial? And if you are, what are the most important elements of this for you? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. And Dan Cassino, John Graby, right straight to our listeners. David's in Concord. Hi, David. Go ahead. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, I just called in to comment that I thought the Democrat, I've listened to almost all of your coverage, and I thought the Democrat, I walked away from the Democrats feeling unclear about what their position, well, I guess I knew what their position was. I just don't feel like they articulated a very strong case. I thought it kind of droned on. It was a harder one to listen to. For me, being a left-leaning independent, I wanted them to have a stronger case. I found the Republicans were really clearly articulating structural arguments, and to what your guests had said, like, they really evaluated kind of constitutional issues and then what sort of dangerous precedent this would set. And I would just say, even though I want Trump out, I feel like the precedent it would set, if I had a president that I liked, I would not want charges like this to pull them out of office. So,
David,
so
really good to hear from you.
Your coverage has been great. Thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling in. And Dan Cassino, I'll throw that one to you. How do you think this played with the American people, you know, Democrats and Republicans?
So, look, the Democrats, the House managers, made their case over the course of 24 hours, over several days, talking for 8 hours at a stretch, saying, laying out every facet of their case. And this was a complicated case to be making. If you remember, the reason Democrats thought this was an easier case to make is this was less complicated than we're talking about with Mueller and the Mueller investigation to Russian interference in 2016. This is a more straightforward. Look, there was a call. There was a quid pro quo. But that case did get complicated over time. And it got complicated, I think, largely because they didn't have direct statements from the people involved, that they didn't have that sort of smoking gun from people with firsthand knowledge. Now, it looks like we've got John Bolton, who claims he has that smoking gun, who claims he has that firsthand knowledge, but he hasn't been heard by the Senate yet. And I think that really complicated the Democrats' effort to make this case. On the other hand, the Republican case, the case from the president's defenders, was very straightforward. They cut it up into small segments where they're making very discrete arguments in those sections. So we had Ken Starr making an argument about the history of impeachment. We had Alan Dershowitz making an argument about what impeachment is supposed to be used for and making an argument opposite the one he made before the Clinton impeachment, saying that it actually requires there to be a crime and that abuse of power is not a crime that fits the bill for impeachment. But again, these are not arguments necessarily that anyone in any legal scholar would necessarily agree with. But they were relatively short, and they were relatively to the point. And I think also it helps the fact that the president's defenders didn't use very much of their time. They finished up really early, thinking they'd made their case, and didn't try and get into those facts. And that fact pattern is what the Democrats are relying on. It is complicated. They were hoping senators were going to follow it. But we did see a lot of senators dozing off or just leaving the room, despite the fact they weren't supposed to be allowed to do that.
Well, and, you know, as we learn in radio, sometimes shorter is better because you get to your point and then you get out. Go ahead, John Graby.
Well, what's different here, too, is that, you know, usually in again, drawing that comparison to a judicial trial, usually the opening argument of the government, of the prosecution, is much shorter because they know that evidence is going to come in. And so it's telling the story at a high level of generality to the jury and saying the evidence is going to show, the witnesses are going to say. And they can't do that here because there's no agreement about you know, future evidence, future witnesses coming in. There is the evidence that was generated during the investigation in the House. And so this was sort of a hybrid. You know, it functioned more like an appellate argument on the basis of the evidence in the House. But the problem with that is an appellate argument is targeting a judgment that's already taken place. This was an argument about what a judgment should be, but it was made without reference to, you know, what the evidence and what the witnesses are going to show, because there's no guarantee we're going to have evidence or witnesses at all.
Well, I definitely want to ask both of you about the witness question, capital T, capital W. But let's go back to our listeners for a moment. Again, our email for you to join us with your comments and reaction about the U.S. Senate impeachment process is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Your questions are welcome too. Celia's calling from Brookfield. Hi, Celia. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening very intently to nearly all of the inquiry and the trial, and I still can't get a conclusive answer to this question. The White House defense attorneys are saying that the subpoenas that were issued during the inquiry were invalid because they weren't voted on by the whole House of Representatives, and I'm trying to figure out how to say it, and the Democrats they say that it was proper for them to issue the subpoenas, and that was the correct thing to do. And I don't think the American public understands which is correct. Are they valid or are they not valid?
Well, see, I hear you, and it has been confusing. And as John Grabe explained earlier, there's a lot of legal language that is used from the regular legal world that doesn't exactly apply to this process. But John, can you help us out? It's a good question, Celia. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I've been focused more on the argument that you know invokes, although it doesn't formally assert executive privilege in response to the subpoenas, in response to the requests that certain witnesses come and testify and that certain information be handed over. There is clearly a difference of opinion between the parties. And I guess I'd comment, too, that it's really stark in this case how much the division between, you know, the two sides really runs along partisan lines. Again, the issue with respect to the second article of impeachment is the extent to which the president is permitted to say, this is all privileged, we're immune, and you have no business asking for this. And, you know, it's an extraordinarily broad conception of privilege. It's an extraordinarily broad conception of immunity. It's unprecedented. And I think that's why, you know, it made its way into an article of impeachment.
Okay. Well, coming up, we will look a little bit more at this idea of executive privilege that you raised, Celia. So thank you. We'll also talk about the big witness bombshell with Mr. Bolton coming forward with his accusations. And we'll hear more from you. We really want your reactions, questions, comments about what we heard in the U.S. Senate over the past several days. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, and we'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, as the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump moves into the questioning phase, we want your reaction this morning on The Exchange. Have you been paying attention to what's been happening in the Senate or tuning it out? What questions do you have about the process itself? We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. Helping us out, John Grabe, professor of law at UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law, director of its Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service. And on the line with us, Dan Cassino, associate professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University and a frequent contributor to NHPR's Civics 101 podcast. And gentlemen, lots of questions from listeners, but I did want to ask you this, Dan, before we go too much further. How do you, as a political scientist, gauge this argument that we've heard from a lot of people? This is all a big waste of time and money. The outcome is a foregone conclusion. The U.S. Senate, controlled by Republicans, is not going to remove a sitting Republican president. So why are we bothering? How do you view that, Dan?
So, look, this is actually a classic argument made against almost everything Congress does. Members of the public want members of Congress to be doing stuff for the public good, passing laws that are going to help everybody. But members of Congress aren't necessarily interested in that. Members of Congress are much more interested in what we call position taking and credit claiming. They want to send a signal to their constituents about what they're doing. And that sort of sending of signals is not necessarily going to be bypassing laws, which is hard. It's going to be by taking symbolic actions, symbolic stances. And that's really what all of this is about. House representatives, when they passed the impeachment, knew that the president was very unlikely to be removed by the Senate. So why did they do it? In order to send a signal to their constituents saying, look, we believe this is unacceptable. And if they didn't do it, then they'd face the consequence of the ballot box. Members of the Senate are doing the same thing, right? Democratic members of the Senate are saying, we are going to stand up to President Trump. And Republican members of the Senate are using this as a loyalty test, showing we are behind the president here. This is all about position taking. It's all about signaling to their constituents. And that's going to be really frustrating for the American public, who sees, look, we've got lots of problems. Why can't we deal with those? The answer is because those problems are hard to deal with, and dealing with those problems isn't necessarily going to help anyone get reelected.
Interesting. So it's easier to grandstand on the floor of the U.S. Senate than it is to work on opioid legislation or highway funding and so forth, Dan.
Absolutely.
Well, what about the idea that, you know, these charges are serious? That's the case that you heard from Democrats. You know, they're kind of making the opposite case that you just made, Dan, that this is a big, big deal and, you know, we hate to do this, but we have to. Here's Congressman Jerry Nadler, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, saying these charges put forth in the articles brought by the House absolutely rise to the level of impeachment. Let's hear.
We fully recognize that impeachment does not exist for a mistake. It does not apply to acts that are merely unwise or unpopular. Impeachment is reserved for deliberate decisions by the president to embark on a course of conduct that betrays his oath of office and does violence to the Constitution. When the president has engaged in such conduct, and when there is strong evidence that he will do so again, when he has told us he'll do so again, when he has told us that it's okay to invite interference from a foreign power into our next election, the case for removal is at its peak.
So that's Jerry Nadler, Congressman, Chair of the House Judiciary Committee. And Dan, so that's another point that Democrats brought up. This is about election integrity for the next election. How well do you think that stuck with American voters?
Yeah, I'm not sure American voters have really gotten into the idea that the president is trying to cheat in the upcoming election. I think a lot of the arguments of election interference fell by the wayside after the Mueller report. Mueller report came out. It did find there was election interference, but you know it was muddled. And because it was muddled, I think a lot of Americans said, "Oh, okay, so we're not going to worry about the election interference side of it." And because of that, I'm not sure people are really taking that as the important point. It is the point the Democrats are trying to make here is, look, you can't just rely on the next election as a remedy for this. The reason you can't rely on the next election is the president, in their view, is cheated in the last election, is trying to cheat in the upcoming election. So if the election itself is not going to be valid, well, you can't just say, let's have another election to resolve the problem. And then impeachment and disqualification for future holding of office is really the only remedy as far as they're concerned.
Let's go back to our listeners, both of you. And Tom's calling from Gilmanton. Hi, Tom. Thanks for being with us. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for the great program.
Good. Go ahead.
My question is this. Could the Senate, as a way to resolve the hassle over whether and how Bolton might testify, could the House, in fact, hold a public hearing and have Bolton come in and testify under oath to the House information that is valuable to the discussion, and that being a way to bring it to the fore and in the public realm without dealing with the Senate directly.
Tom, I'm so glad you called, because John and Dan, we do need to talk about this. So Dan to you first, but then you too, John. So just remind us, for people who haven't been tuning in, what this sort of Bolton bombshell was earlier this week.
All right. So John Bolton is a longstanding member of the Republican National Security Establishment. He's known for being a hawk, for being in favor of armed aggression against our enemies like North Korea and Syria and Iran. And so he joined the Trump White House, and it did seem to be an odd fit because President Trump, of course, was very skeptical of the approach John Bolton has for decades been proposing. So he didn't last very long. He was National Security Advisor. He was there for a while and then got forced out. And after he was forced out, he wrote a book, because why not? Seems to be the popular thing to
do. A lot of people do that, yeah.
And in December, he had the draft of his book done. The book's supposed to come out in March. So as he's required to do as someone who had a security clearance, he submitted the book back to the White House to get security clearance. As far as John Bolton says, he says, look, there's nothing in here that's classified, that's dangerous. Not talking about troop movements or anything that's going on right now. So he submitted it to the White House. The White House took it, and they have not, at this point, reviewed it. They normally have 30 days to review or right at the end of that period. In that book, according to excerpts that have been gathered by news organizations, Bolton basically says he has firsthand knowledge of the quid pro quo that the Democrats are alleging, that President Trump told him repeatedly and said out loud, oh, I'm going to withhold this money until they agree to investigate, or at least announce an investigation into Burisma and Hunter Biden. And that's exactly what Democrats are alleging. The thing Democrats have been criticized for is, well, you have no firsthand knowledge of this. Well, we've got second and third-hand knowledge of this from the whistleblower, from other people. And that's largely because the people who have firsthand knowledge have not been allowed, have been asked, but have not been allowed to testify. The president ordered members of his cabinet and anyone with firsthand knowledge not to testify before the House, saying that it was illegitimate inquiry. He didn't want to send them up for oversight. So now, Bolton, we've got these excerpts in the book. It looks like Bolton is a fact witness. Bolton has said he is willing to testify before the Senate. And the question is whether the Senate is going to call him or not. Now, to the question your caller brought up, why can't the House just bring him up? And that actually wouldn't resolve the issue. I think it's likely the House may investigate him, although Bolton in the past was up in the air about whether he would agree to testify before the House or not, given that the president had ordered people not to testify at the House. However, it wouldn't actually resolve the underlying issue here. The argument Republican senators are making is they should only be considering information that was in the articles of impeachment and the impeachment evidence that was sent over by the House when they sent the impeachment.
So you can't open that back up, basically.
Right. So further evidence, well, that wouldn't matter because we're not going to, they're going to say we can't use that further evidence they're bringing in.
John, you got to help us out with this. The witness issue, and are witnesses typically part of an impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate?
Historically, they have been. I mean, this was the rules of this impeachment were modeled on the rules that were used in the impeachment of President Bill Clinton back in the late 90s. And in this situation, as there, the decision on whether to call witnesses was deferred until after the opening arguments of both sides were made. But in that case, witnesses were deposed, and there were witnesses.
So who sets the rules for witnesses, yes or no? Is that Mitch McConnell?
Well, Dan might actually know more just from the political perspective, but
sure.
My understanding is that there are standing rules of impeachment that have been adopted over time, and that those rules are sort of baked in. They can be changed, but I think they have to be changed by a two-thirds majority vote. On the other hand, though, there are more context-specific or case-specific rules that can be adopted in this particular impeachment, and that is, of course, controlled by the majority in the Senate.
Those rules. Dan, can you shed some more light on this?
Sure. So impeachment rules are entirely up in the air. The reason we're working with the Clinton impeachment rules is because the Andrew Johnson impeachment was too long ago and didn't make a lot of sense. That said, the Clinton impeachment rules were based on the impeachment of Andrew Johnson in the 1860s.
Yeah.
So these rules are basically up to the Senate. So there are standing rules, as John said, but those standing rules can be abridged not by a two-thirds vote, but in fact by a majority vote in the Senate. So 51 votes, they can do whatever they want. The rules of evidence in the trial don't apply. So, for instance, attorney-client privilege, not a thing, doesn't matter. They can do hearsay rules, doesn't apply. Anything, they can adopt any rules they want, or even adopt the rules we'd have in a real trial if they have 51 votes to do it. And that's really what all this tension is about right now. There are enough Republicans that if all the Republicans stick together, then Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, can do whatever he wants and run the trial whatever he wants, which is to have it a very short trial, basically end it after the question-and-answer period we're going to have over the next couple of days. However, if four Republicans and all the Democrats go against him, and then they're able to essentially run the trial however they want, bring in witnesses, extend it for months if they want, and there's nothing Mitch McConnell can do about it as long as there's 51 votes in support of that rules change.
Well, and what you're saying, Dan, just highlights what John Grabe keeps telling us, is it's a trial, but it's not exactly like a regular court trial with a judge and a jury and so on and so forth. This has been a big issue over the last day or so in the U.S. Senate. Here is New York Congressman again, Jerry Nadler, chair of the Judiciary Committee, one of the leaders on the House side of this, urging the Senate to allow witnesses and comparing the impeachment process to a regular court proceeding.
A real trial, we know, has witnesses. We urge you to do your duty, permit a fair trial. All the witnesses must be permitted. That's elementary in American justice. Either you want the truth, or you must permit the witnesses, or you want a shameful cover-up. History will judge, and so will the electorate.
So, John, again, you know, he says this is what we normally do, but you keep reminding us this isn't a normal proceeding.
And there's nowhere to go for those who object to what's happening, because, again, the federal courts have made it very clear that this is up to the political branches. This is not something that you can then take an appeal to the federal courts to say the way in which the trial was conducted in the Senate does not comport with, you know, basic understandings about how legal proceedings should work. So that's just not something that the federal courts are going to entertain.
Go ahead, Dan.
President's lawyer Rudy Giuliani has said that he believes the Supreme Court could overturn the impeachment if the president were actually removed, which is a bizarre and very novel legal theory.
Wow. Okay. So we heard about, you know, we heard the call for witnesses and then others saying, no, we don't need witnesses. This process is sort of moving forward. And then we had one of the president's lawyers, Alan Dershowitz, saying, you know, even if John Bolton does come in and even if he does say, yes, this happened, it's not impeachable. Let's hear.
If a president, any president, were to have done what the Times reported about the contact of the Bolton manuscript, that would not constitute an impeachable offense. Let me repeat, nothing in the Bolton revelations, even if true, would rise to the level of an abuse of power or an impeachable offense. That is clear from the history. That is clear from the language of the Constitution. You cannot turn conduct that is not impeachable into impeachable conduct simply by using words like quid pro quo and personal benefit.
This is something, John Grabe, that we have been, and I mean we in the media and just the public at large, have been wrestling with since this whole thing got started. What is an impeachable offense? The founders weren't very clear about this.
Well, the text of the Constitution says treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. The high crimes and misdemeanors language is an explicit invocation of the English common law tradition, because we inherited that tradition, and impeachment was part of that heritage. What Professor Dershowitz is arguing is that there needs to be a violation of federal criminal law in order for the House to conclude and the Senate to conclude that there have been high crimes or misdemeanors, because treason and bribery are both crimes. I don't know of any constitutional scholar who's actually in agreement with Professor Dershowitz on this point. Even the Harvard colleague that he cited for this proposition, there is actually a Harvard Law Review article that was written a couple of years ago by a guy named Nico Bowie, where he agreed with the proposition that there has to be criminal conduct. But he made very clear yesterday that he doesn't agree with Professor Dershowitz's bottom line, because he thinks that the articles of impeachment do very clearly allege conduct that constitute and have been understood to constitute crimes going back to the time of the founding.
Let's take another call. This is Cheryl in Londonderry. Hi, Cheryl. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
So listening a little bit earlier, I did hear some of the gentleman was explaining how they were opposed to sending it over to the Senate before they had all the evidence and having enough people testify and that sort of thing. And I think the obstruction alone says a lot about whether or not we should consider there's a problem and we need to have additional witnesses. And I also feel like the urgency was there. I really do feel like he got away with cheating in the last election and is actively doing that in this election. To me, that is sort of a time is of the essence sense of urgency thing. But what I'm curious about is if they are successful in getting the votes to not have witnesses in this case in the Senate trial, is it possible for the Chief Justice, for John Roberts, to say, wait a minute, we've heard a lot of evidence here that we haven't got conclusions on, and I think witnesses are necessary? Is that even an option for him to do something like that, or is there a way that he could have an input on that?
Wow, Cheryl, it's a great question. John, you first?
Yeah, in fact, there was an article or a column written a couple of days ago and published in the newspaper by Neil Katyal and a couple of others arguing that it is possible that Democrats can, under the Senate rules, ask the Chief Justice himself to issue subpoenas. And that their argument is that, you know, a majority of the Senate cannot override that decision. What the majority of the Senate can do, once the evidence comes in to the court, to the Senate, and or the witnesses show up at the Senate, is they can then decide not to hear from them. But they were urging Democrats to actually go to the Chief Justice and ask him to issue subpoenas on his own authority as part of the constitutional obligation that he has to preside over the Senate trial.
Wow, that's a big role for the Chief Justice there.
Well, if that interpretation were shared by the Chief Justice and he were to do that. But even in those circumstances, it's still ultimately up to the Senate majority whether or not those witnesses and that evidence is going to come in.
Well, here's an email that came in from Sarah, who says, I've been following the impeachment trial fairly closely, listening to live coverage on NHPR in the evenings. But the whole thing, Sarah says, the trial and NPR's coverage leaves me pretty irritated. Sarah says, a main source of my irritation that I hope you will address on the show is the lack of media coverage given to the argument made by Alan Dershowitz on Trump's defense that, though the president may have done bad things, including quid pro quo, quote, these actions are not impeachable. Sarah says, as a liberal-leaning moderate, this argument is compelling for me, and I feel like NPR has omitted analysis of this argument. Sarah says, Alan Dershowitz made it clear in his statement during the trial that a chief reason not to have Bolton or anyone testify is that whether there was or wasn't quid pro quo is irrelevant to whether or not the president should be impeached. So, Sarah, thank you very much for that email. And, Dan, quick thought from you on what Sarah says.
Sure. So the, one of the reasons no one's addressing Dershowitz's argument there is that Dershowitz's argument is not shared by anybody. It is straight just Dershowitz kind of talking. It seems like it's made up after the fact. The other issue is Dershowitz actually making a relatively subtle argument that if the president does something within his own powers, like foreign policy, if he does it with corrupt intent, the fact that he does with his powers is the only important part, and the corrupt intent doesn't matter. And that is a terrifying precedent if we were to take it. So it means the president could accept money to bomb somebody because he has the right to bomb people under as commander-in-chief. And so if he takes a bribe to do that, the fact he has the power to do it in general, so therefore the bribe doesn't matter. It's a bizarre argument. I think it's getting, sadly, about as much airplay as it should get because it is an argument that no one outside of Alan Dershowitz takes seriously. I think it's put forward as kind of a fig leaf to allow Republicans to say, well, we're just going to dispose of this without it.
Okay.
Shouldn't be taken seriously.
Sarah's got another point, too, about the Bidens that I want to follow up on after a short break. So, Sarah, thank you, and we'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, as the Oscars approach, we go to the movies. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, we are gauging your reaction to the impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate that we've been hearing over the last 5 or 6 days. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. With us on the line is Dan Cassino, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fairleigh Dickinson University and a frequent contributor to NHPR's Civics 101 podcast. With me in studio, John Grabe, Professor of Law at UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law and Director of its Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service. And both of you, lots more commentary from our listeners, but I did want to go back to Sarah, whose email I read earlier about Alan Dershowitz. Sarah says, a second issue I have with the whole thing is the Bidens. Sarah says, while I agree that the Democrats, that whatever the Bidens were doing is largely irrelevant to whether Trump should or shouldn't be impeached, or whether what he did was wrong, Sarah says, I would like an investigation into them. I want them to answer for any wrongdoing. And if there wasn't any explicit wrongdoing, but rather just the same old story of power and privilege and money, then I want everyone, Democratic voters, including myself, to know about it. Again, Sarah, thank you for raising that. And what about the Bidens, Dan? One of the president's lawyers complained yesterday that they were operating in a Biden-free zone.
Yeah, so this is something the Republicans have been arguing about a lot. If you were to turn on Sean Hannity last night, he spent his entire show talking about how the Bidens are getting off scot-free. The Bidens are really the ones who are all corrupt here. And look, I think there is an argument made here that the Bidens, even if they didn't do anything technically illegal, and there really isn't any allegation there's anything any illegal activity going on the part of the Bidens, especially Hunter Biden, it's not a good look. I mean, the question becomes about nepotism, right? Why would you hire Joe Biden's son to be on the board of a company who knows nothing about that? And the answer is because he's Joe Biden's son. You're going to pay him money in order to get that sort of connection. And this is not something that's limited to Joe Biden, Hunter Biden. This is something the president's children have taken great advantage of. And so there is this tradition of nepotism, especially on foreign boards and corporate boards, and that is troubling. And I think it should be troubling for everyone. I think it's a little silly that the president, the people defending Donald Trump, are going to argue that nepotism and giving children of some politicians' children high offices because they're politicians' children is a problem. That's a little bit of a silly argument for the president's defenders to be making, given the president's children are all involved in very similar deals around the world. But there is something there, and I think there has been enough smoke there that people do want to see an investigation. And Democrats, even if they say this is irrelevant, I think are probably going to feel some pressure to address this. Joe Biden on the campaign trail has been very aggressive pushing back against this. But there are questions there, and certainly something's going to be used against him if he were to get the nomination for the November election.
Sarah, thank you so much for that email. And here's one from Linda in Franconia, who says, the bias on your show today seems to be that the impeachment is political. She's got other really good points to make. But John Graby, you said at the beginning, saying impeachment is political isn't disparaging of impeachment. It's a political process.
Yeah, I mean, when I say that it's political, I mean that as a descriptive term. I don't mean, you know, that as a normative argument, you know, that politics are bad or that it being political is bad. It's just descriptively, it is a political process that is unfolding. Right. And what I'm trying
process.
To draw a contrast between is a political process such as what is unfolding right now and a judicial process and what would unfold in a courtroom. Because as you said before, so much of the language and so many of the procedures seem to be drawn from our judicial tradition, but there are real differences.
So, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, John. So it's a political process for the reasons you described, but also because politicians are acting as judge and jury, so that inherently makes it a political process.
That's right. That's exactly right. The Constitution makes this a political process in terms of who it assigns responsibility for with respect to impeachment and removal.
Okay. Well, Linda, thank you very much for that email. And here's one from Todd, who says, if the Senate decides not to call witnesses, can the House then reopen impeachment hearings and possibly submit new articles of impeachment? Wow, Todd, I haven't even thought about that. Thank you. John, new articles of impeachment.
There's certainly no bar against that. There is, again, drawing from our judicial tradition, there is in our tradition this idea that it is unfair to twice put somebody into jeopardy. We have a constitutional prohibition known as the Double Jeopardy Clause that says that if you've been prosecuted and acquitted by a sovereign, you cannot then be prosecuted again for the same conduct. Now, that's an entitlement, a right that belongs to criminal defendants. It does not, by its terms, apply to the president. And so my sense is that, yes, that would be permissible, but it would need to involve new stuff, new witnesses, new allegations, probably for it to fly politically.
All right. Well, here's some more emails from our listeners. And Karen in Laconia says, my takeaway is that Pelosi resisted calls for impeachment until the president's primary offense was to attempt to tamper with the 2020 elections. At that point, they could not want to wait to hear to the election to decide if he stays or goes. Karen, thank you. Sorry, I bungled the end of your email there. But what do you think, Dan, that Nancy Pelosi really didn't want to do this, but it just got so compelling that she had to?
I think it's less about the compellingness of the charges and more about the political pressures that Speaker Pelosi was facing. Speaker Pelosi essentially stopped and said, no, we're not going to do impeachment because she viewed it as being a partisan exercise. She thought it would hurt, and she thought really it was going to hurt freshman members of the Democratic Party who were up in swing districts. Here in New Jersey, we have three districts that flipped, battle line districts that flipped towards the Democrats in the last election. Nancy Pelosi was very worried about those districts, saying, look, these people, if they wind up looking too partisan, they could lose the reelection bid. So she was trying to protect her members. What happened, if you remember, is that a group of those members, they call themselves National Security Democrats, came out and said, look, we want impeachment. At that point, the people she's trying to protect say, no, we want to impeach the president. And she didn't really have a leg to stand on anymore. She thought politically it was going to be good for liberal Democrats if they impeach the president, because, again, this is about showing that they're doing what their constituents want. And if the swing Democrats thought it was good for them in their districts, well, then it became a win-win for Nancy Pelosi.
So political predictions are dangerous, Dan, but you're a political scientist, so I'm going to ask you to do it anyway. With the Clinton impeachment, we saw some negative fallout for Republicans. Will Democrats pay a political price for this impeachment?
It seems very unlikely. The reason, so if we look at the polling of the Clinton impeachment, support for the impeachment and removal of Bill Clinton never got above about 35% of the electorate. It was really only hardcore Republicans, not even all Republicans, that were in favor of impeaching and removing Bill Clinton. And so there was a lot of blowback against Republicans when they went ahead with this unpopular policy. For Democrats, there's much more support. We've seen polling in recent days for, saying that about 50% of the American public wants the president removed. Now, that's way higher than we got under Clinton. That's actually even higher than we ever got under Richard Nixon. And as a result, there's less downside here. The Democrats are doing something that is broadly popular in their own among their own constituents and pretty popular among independents as well. So there's simply less political price to be paid for it.
We heard from a listener in Keene who didn't want her name to be used, and she made reference to the Nixon impeachment. So some listeners are definitely making that connection. Let's hear from her.
All this in the Senate has just been blowing up a lot of smoke and mirrors. The facts seem to be pretty simple, which is that from all the evidence before the first committee and in the transcript of the phone that Trump keeps telling us to read the transcript of, it seems he did exactly what he is accused of doing, which is solicit dirt on one of his opponents. Now, I haven't heard anybody else mention this, but it seems to me a direct parallel to Watergate, which is what that was all about, was finding dirt on one of Nixon's opponents. And that was what brought down Nixon.
Again, that's a listener from Keene. Thank you for that input. Again, we are taking your reactions and questions about what we've seen in the U.S. Senate over these past couple days in terms of the impeachment proceedings there, which begin again this afternoon. And, of course, you can hear that live on NHPR. John Grabe, so comparisons by that listener to Nixon's impeachment. I've also heard a lot of comparisons to Bill Clinton's impeachment. What other sort of ties do you see between these two processes, either from a legal or political perspective?
Well, I think that's actually a very astute observation that the caller in from Keene made. I mean, it really, Watergate was at first about an effort to gain unfair advantage in the electoral process, some would say to corrupt an election, and then it quickly transformed into also a proceeding that about the cover-up that ensued and, the institutional damage that was wrought that went right up to the very top, went right up to the presidency. I think the parallels here are actually really pretty stark. The Clinton impeachment, what's interesting to draw comparison to there is we have, again, the president's defense team arguing that abuse of power, which is the title of the first article impeachment this time, that abuse of power is not an impeachable offense. But abuse of power was one of the articles of impeachment in the Clinton impeachment, as also it was going to be one of the articles of impeachment in the Nixon impeachment as well.
We've gotten a couple emails from listeners who want to know more about Chief Justice John Roberts' role. And one of the roles that we heard him play this week in the U.S. Senate is trying to maintain decorum. We're going to play a little bit of audio when Roberts jumps in after a particularly testy exchange between Representative Jerry Nadler and Pat Cipollone. Each said the other should be, quote unquote, embarrassed by their behavior and their statements. And here's Justice Roberts trying to dial down the temperature in the room.
I think it is appropriate at this point for me to admonish both the House managers and the President's counsel in equal terms to remember that they are addressing the world's greatest deliberative body. One reason it has earned that title is because its members avoid speaking in a manner and using language that is not conducive to civil discourse. In the 1905 Swain trial, a senator objected when one of the managers used the word pettifogging, and the presiding officer said the word ought not to have been used. I don't think we need to aspire to that high a standard, but I do think those addressing the Senate should remember where they are.
So admonished, John Graby, by the Chief Justice of the United States. Wow. How do you think Justice Roberts feels about being put in this role?
Well, Chief Justice Roberts is an institutionalist, and I think there's every reason to think that he is probably very concerned about the prestige of the court that he presides over and more generally the public's view of the federal courts, because judicial politics have become so partisan. My strong hunch is that to the extent that he can remain invisible, that is a good thing from the Chief Justice's perspective.
So by saying he's an institutionalist, it means he cares about the court very, very much and its reputation in American history.
That's right. And whenever the court involves itself in highly contentious matters and is appears to come down on one side or the other, it spends capital and it enrages enrages those who disagree with what it does. And I think Chief Justice Roberts is acutely aware of that. And I think, I made reference before to the op-ed that was written the other day suggesting that the Chief Justice could take a more active role and under Senate rules. My strong hunch is that that's not something that he's looking to do.
Here's an email from Charles who says, as a libertarian-leaning moderate, I have been absolutely appalled at the blanket refusal from Trump to comply. He is not a king, Charles says. This is how guilty people behave. To avert your attention from Trump's own behavior is congressional negligence. Charles says Trump is trying to cheat in the upcoming election, and it saddens me that more Americans aren't outraged about this. House managers also tried to make this point. It isn't just about what the president did in the past. It's what he might do about the future election. I want to play a little bit from California Representative Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee. He's making the connection between the Kremlin and the White House. We're going to hear Schiff quoting what Russian leader Vladimir Putin said in November after President Trump put forward the discredited theory that Ukraine, not Russia, had interfered in the 2016 elections.
Thank God, Putin says. Well, you got to give Donald Trump credit for this. He has made a religious man out of Vladimir Putin. But I don't think we really want Vladimir Putin, our adversary, to be thanking God for the President of the United States, because they don't wish us well.
Now, Dan, I know you were struck by that Kremlin connection that some House managers made. What do you think?
Well, look, this is the strongest argument the House can make, is to say, look, this is about protecting the integrity of elections. And you'll note, your listeners note, both sides are arguing this is about protecting the integrity of elections. The Republicans, the president's defenders, saying, look, we have to protect the integrity of the 2020 election by giving people the choice of whoever they want as their candidates and laying Donald Trump beyond the ballot again. We've got Democrats saying, look, This is cheating in the election, and we can't afford to let this go through to the next election. Now, I think when the Democrats talk about Vladimir Putin, talk about the Kremlin, they are getting off topic. And this is something some of the listeners have brought in saying, look, it seems unfocused. They're talking about all this other stuff rather than sticking to the very basic fact pattern that they have with Ukraine and the president's attempts to extort Ukraine.
So in this case, Dan, you hear both the president's lawyers and the Democratic House managers saying, we are the defenders of America's next election.
And they're both saying, we are the people who are in favor of the American public, and we are the people who are protecting the Constitution and mom and apple pie and all of that. And it's going to be up to the voters to decide who's actually telling the truth.
So, John Graby, today's Wednesday. What's on tap for today, and what are the next major steps that you'll be watching?
So, we've now proceeded to the part of the trial where the senators can pose written questions to both the House managers and to the president's defense team. They have to be written down. There's no opportunity to follow up. The Chief Justice has asked that the questions be framed in such a way that they can be answered within 5 minutes. Because the House managers, usually in a criminal trial, the prosecution gets to make its opening argument, then the defense makes its opening argument, then the prosecution actually is entitled to a rebuttal, to respond, to reply to what was raised that they didn't, address in their opening argument. That opportunity is not provided for by the Senate rules. So I think everybody is expecting that in their responses, the House managers in particular will be trying to respond to the defense that's been raised over the last several days.
And the way that Mitch McConnell described it yesterday, it sounds like it's going to be, John, a muted process, not like some of that really pretty gripping testimony that we heard in the House, people asking tough questions, long pauses, tough follow-ups. They're going to submit their questions in writing.
Right.
The Chief Justice will read them.
Right.
And then they'll have 5 minutes. That's it, to respond. So it sounds like it's going to be more low-key on purpose.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people say, pointing to the Clinton impeachment trial, that this was not a terribly energizing and exciting part of that proceeding.
All right. Well, it all starts up again this afternoon on NHPR. But for now, Dan Cassino, thank you very much for helping us out. We really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Dan Cassino, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, frequent contributor to NHPR's Civics 101 podcast. John Grabe, a big thank you to you, too.
Absolutely.
John Grabe, Professor of Law, UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law, Director of the Rudman Center there. And you've been listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.